This is Rick Thomas. Welcome to Life Over Coffee. Today I am quite excited. I have an interview with Dave Furman. He is a pastor in Dubai, of all places. And well, Dave, let me say this. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thanks, Rick. It's a joy to be with you here today.
You've written a book here, and that's the point of our podcast. And I have a handful of questions that I want to talk to you about. Dave, your book, Being There, this book is a twist. Dave struggles with chronic pain, and he's going to share that with you of how all that happened. But he didn't write the book so much about talking about his pain, but the book is written from the perspective of how other people can care for a person who is suffering, which makes this book, in my view, fantastic, because we want to know what to do for people besides just stare at them and be perplexed and struggle with our own fear of man issues, because we don't know what to do, what to say. And so Dave has a book here, again, Being There, How to Love Those Who Are Hurting. So Dave, can you, what's the name of your disease, if you don't mind, and when did it begin? What does it do to you?
Yeah, thanks, Rick. I have a few things wrong with my ulnar nerve, which is one of the two main nerves in each of my arms, and I struggle with it in both arms. One problem is called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. It's a degenerative nerve disease. It's stayed relatively stable the last few years, but it's rendered me, over the course of the last decade, disabled. I can do a few things with my arms. I can lift about 2 pounds. I can't drive. I can't put on my seatbelt. I can't pack my bag or open any doors. I can't shake hands with people. I have much muscle atrophy in my arms, as you can imagine. And so there's not much I can do. By God's grace, as I pastor, I can move my arms around. I can type a little bit. I can type slowly. I can use kind of voice recognition software as well. I can't write with my hand. And so there's quite a bit of limitation over my life and what I can do, which means my wife Gloria has to literally carry the weight of the family in many ways.
Dave, so I have a video here in the show notes that you guys did. I guess it's a promo for the book. And as I look at the video, I mean, you look absolutely normal, like there's nothing wrong. So when somebody comes up to you, I mean, the first thing they want to do is shake your hand. How awkward is that? What do you do?
Yeah, it's actually quite difficult for a pastor. That's part of the pastor's job, right? All pastors preach and shake hands. That's all we do. We preach and then we shake hands afterwards.
And eat chicken.
Oh yeah, but it's a challenge, especially if I'm wearing a long sleeve shirt and you can't see the scars in my arms. It's difficult. Our church knows. Redeemer Church of Dubai is so gracious and loving. They know my disability. Of course, there's always new people, and if I travel, there's conferences and churches I'm at. So it's a constant thing. It's one of the first things anybody wants to do. And so in many ways, it's unfortunate. It's the very first thing I have to call attention to, and just saying, I can't shake your hand. I've had surgeries on my arms. I'm disabled. So I often will say something like, I'm disabled and I'm unable to shake hands. That automatically leads into more questions. And for a while, it definitely was uncomfortable and difficult. Now, it's just part of life, and it'd be odd probably for that person to not ask anything after that. So I understand that. And the Lord has worked on my own heart to be gracious and just to explain and to be patient with people. It was also hard for a while. I would just try to shake hands. Of course, that would lead to quite high pain levels. And so I've stopped and trust the Lord to not get my significance in whether I can shake someone's hand or whether I have strength.
So when they there's an irony here, is that you're the one that's suffering, and so we should lead you, should serve you, should help you walk through your suffering. But what you're describing is if I came up to you and wanted to shake your hand, you actually have to lead me through your suffering, because I'm the one that's feeling awkward. I feel like I've said the wrong thing, or I've crossed some kind of invisible line that I'm embarrassed about. And so you have to step up and lead me, to comfort me, to remove the awkwardness from the room. So you find yourself leading other people, and you had to become comfortable with that.
Yeah, I guess a good point. Yeah, I've had to, and it is a way if I'm in the right mind and I'm looking at trying to serve others and serving Christ on a regular basis, then there are some things that the hurting person can certainly do to help forego the awkwardness. It's one thing for someone to have a visible disability that obviously creates perhaps some awkwardness for the other person or people. In my case, I have no visible disability. You said you watched the video. Maybe if you watch closely, there's some twitches of my arms and things like that. But in general, yep. You don't notice. And if I have long sleeves, you can't see the thinness of my arms. And so when someone wants to do something normal, like shake a hand or whatever it may be, it does create an awkwardness that the Lord's had to help me work through over the years.
Yeah, it reminds me, it's an echo of Christ. Christ is going to the cross to die for the world, and he's going through tremendous suffering, but yet he found himself leading his people because, like, you know, Peter, for example, just couldn't get his mind around what Christ wanted to do. And when Christ needed his disciples to lead or to help him, he had to actually lead them. Hey, how old are you, Dave?
I'll be 38 next week.
All right, so you said 10 years ago, so you're 28 years old?
Yeah, my wife and I have been married for, it'll be 15 years in September. It's probably been 11 years, to be honest. I think 3, maybe 4 years into marriage, I started noticing in my right arm, my small two fingers really stopped working, and I stopped the ability to control them. So it's been a good chunk of my whole pastoral ministry here. 75% of our marriage has been struggling through this.
That is really unbelievable. Is this a rare disease?
Somewhat. I've run into different people that have different types of problems with their nerves. Basically, it's neuropathy. My nerves aren't firing off well. And so right now in my elbows and my forearms, my nerves just aren't operating properly. So what they're doing is they're sending pain signals to my brain. So my brain is telling me that my arms are on fire, that they're burning and, you know, twitching, tingling, all those things. So some of that is just the nerves aren't connecting properly with my brain. And so I'm feeling something that's just really not happening. My arms are not on fire, but that's what they feel like to me. And of course, that leads to all kinds of weakness and the inability to really control and deal with about half my hand.
Yeah, at such a young age, it seems even more compounded because you're really, you know, at the height of your strength and your powers. How do you have you wrestled through what you call the both Gloria and you said the same thing. She said it at the end of the book, the if only game. If only my arms weren't hurting, if only I were not struggling this way. What are some practical things that you did just to take your thoughts captive in that area?
Well, it was tough. I didn't do much positive for a while. So we moved out here to the Middle East to plant this church. And we had thought that through a double arm surgery that I had 4 months before arriving, that the problem was going to be okay. But 1 month into our work here, I was driving our vehicle and I was turning around in the parking lot quite a bit because I couldn't find a parking space. And my wife, Gloria, was in the supermarket. By the time she came out, I had just taken a turn around, a left turn, and both my arms just almost instantly felt like they stopped working and I couldn't really control the car very well, put it in park and just had to wait. And that was really the beginning of the hardest year and a half of our lives. I spiraled into a deep, dark depression. I had boils on my fingers. I couldn't touch anything. I couldn't pick up a metal fork and couldn't pick up a bottle of water. I couldn't really, at that point, I was rendered almost completely disabled, and the depression was dark. The clouds of depression hovered over me, and in some sense, we felt like God had brought us out to the Middle East to destroy us. That's what it felt like. And part of the consolation Gloria had that I wasn't going to do something crazy was the fact that I literally couldn't open the front door to leave. She knew I was gonna be there. I would pace up and down our bedroom at night and just in pain, just yelling at myself, yelling to myself, yelling just whatever I could. And that whole time Gloria is there in bed, oftentimes awake, pacing in her own mind, also in a time of despair. And so for about a year, almost a year and a half, I didn't do it well. I wasn't taking my thoughts captive to the obedience of Christ. And then towards the end of that, about a year and a half in, a few things were really helpful. We had a couple of friends really rebuke me for my selfishness. That was overflowing out of the depression. And here's where I started and began to take my thoughts captive, is got a hold of just a little book. I already had it, but a book by Milton Vincent. I don't know if you've seen The Gospel Primer, this little thin book.
Yep.
That someone had given right before we left, that. And then I was reading some, I think something on the gospel by Tim Keller and maybe a few other things, but really the Gospel Primer was super helpful. Just preaching the gospel to myself. I had also read that same year, Spiritual Depression by Martin Lloyd-Jones.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Same idea, kind of Psalm 42, rather than listening to yourself and the lies. And so for me, I was listening to the fact that I was in so much pain, there's no way I could find joy. So I said 100 times a day, if only my arms were healed, then I'd be okay. If only my arms didn't hurt, then I'd be okay. And then the rest of the time I'd say, I wish I was dead. I wish I was dead because I have no hope. And so I was listening to these lies. And then what Martin Lloyd-Jones was saying, what Milton Vincent was saying, what Tim Keller and others were saying, and what the psalmist in Psalm 42 was saying is stop listening to the lies, but start talking to yourself. And so the psalmist there is arguing with himself basically in that psalm. And so I started doing that. And so practically it was a helpful reminder for me to remember what our Lord Jesus had done for me on the cross and dying on the cross, taking upon himself the full weight of the wrath of God, taking upon himself all of my sins, taking upon himself all of the justice that and payment that I couldn't pay for my transgressions. And he took that upon himself and then died and then rose from the dead, proving that it was complete. And so I needed to rehearse the gospel and remember the truth. So that was probably the best and most helpful thing during that time.
Brother, you're talking about some complicated stuff. And so you are in the midst of just severe pain, this unrelenting. It reminds me of what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15:33 that corrupt friends or bad companions corrupt. Well, you've turned that around and you surrounded yourself with good friends. You mentioned a couple of books, Lloyd-Jones and Milton Vincent. You've mentioned, obviously, the scripture. But one of the things that you said as you were just talking, that you had some close friends who rebuked you. Now, that's hardcore. And it's really at the heart of what your book is about. The book, I'm talking to Dave Furman. He's written a book called Being There, How to Love Those Who Are Hurting. Your book is for me and it's for everybody else of how to care for you. So one of your friends or a couple of your friends rebuked you. What would you say to the sufferer, for the people who are looking at the sufferer, the caregivers? You just don't walk up to somebody and rebuke them, somebody who is suffering, but yet that's something that you needed. Now, you're not saying that everybody should do this to the sufferer. These were close friends, but it was a part of what you needed. And so we're all looking at you. We all want to help. We're all a little bit nervous about it. What would you say to us? How can we get closer to you and to serve you as you go through this?
Yeah. So, great point. We do need to be careful. We don't want to be like Job's friends, right? So,
Yep. You
know, Job's friends were actually amazing. They were great. If you read the book of Job, they were amazing. They go and they sit in sackcloth and ashes. They go and they weep with Job. They go and they sit with Job. They were incredible. The text tells us for 7 days they did all that. You could say that Job's friends were amazing until they opened their mouths.
Until they started talking. Hey, so you said in the book, How to Hate Your Hurting Friends into Greater Despair. Can you explain that to me? It jumped off the audio when I heard it.
Well, to do what Job's friends did, they opened their mouths. They started accusing him. They started blaming him for his suffering, saying, your sin brought this on. You did it. What sin are you hiding and not confessing? They assume they started with Job's fault equals Job's suffering. Job's sin automatically would bring suffering. That's just not how the world works. There is discipline for sin. Sometimes there are consequences, certainly, for our sin, but we also live in a fallen world where the consequence to sin in general is that there is death. Unless Jesus comes back before we die, we will die. There's cancer. There's disabilities. There's depression, sorrow. There are these consequences of the fall. There's also other people's sin and the consequences for specific sin. So it's not a one for one thing. And so one way we can lead our friends into despair is blaming them. It's not showing grace and sympathy when they're in pain. So with Job's friends, those first 7 days, they sat with him. They encouraged him. They mourned with him for his loss. And so there's a sense of even the title of my book, being there. There's a sense that those friends just showed up and they were there. And so you don't rush into things like rebukes. The reason that rebuke worked so well, number one, God was preparing my heart for it, but these were close friends, and they had taken time. They had taken time to really assess and see, talk to my wife as well, so they knew what was going on. They came, they drove several hours away, stayed with us the whole weekend for 3 days, and they brought it up in a real loving and caring way at the right time. And so there's a timeliness, there's a prayerful and discerning time, but a way you can help the hurting is at the right time, in the right place, in the right tone, prayerfully bringing up areas where they need to grow. Because for any of us, when we're in pain, I think David Powlison talks about it like this. He has an illustration where he takes a bottle of water and he holds it up on the platform as he speaks, and he starts shaking the bottle and smashing the bottle. He says, "This bottle is your life. The water inside of it is your sin." And as he smashes the bottle and says, "As I smash this bottle and shake the bottle, that's your life. That's your circumstances. That's your difficult days. That's your disability." And as he does that, water starts spilling onto the floor. And he says after that, he says, "Why is the water on the floor?" Well, you could say, because you shook the bottle. But he goes on and says, no, it's because there was water in the bottle. Right. The shaking of the bottle, your circumstances only brought out what was already in your life. And that's what happened to me. I did not know I had an anger problem. I didn't know I was impatient. I didn't know I was being mean to my wife. And it got exasperated. It was blown up. It was multiplied in my disability and suffering. It was there for everybody to see. And my friends took that opportunity in the right setting to bring that up. But it was done in gentleness and kindness with much grace. And like I said, you want to be very careful. They were pointing to tangible things they saw. Job's friends, they were making accusations they knew nothing about.
Yeah, you can't overstate the value of close friends. It reminds me of, Paul said in Romans 8:31 that if God is for us, who can be against us? And as we model that in our lives, there's a for me aspect of the gospel. And you knew without question that your friends were for you. And because they were for you, you could receive a stern rebuke from them. And within that context of love and being for Dave, it is acceptable. Of course, if they don't know you, it would come across wrong and harsh and probably not as redemptive as it was for you. But at the end of the day, you needed to be you were spiraling down in despair, and you needed some tough love spoken to you in that moment. Hey, so you talked about in the book that the sufferer grieves as he is going through your chronic pain, but you also talked about those who are around the sufferer. You would not know this, but my wife has just gone through breast cancer, and she had a mastectomy a couple of weeks ago. And so we've been walking through a cancer journey over the past year, and when I was listening to your book, I experienced this, but I had not put it in those words when you talked about the caregiver grieving. I was actually grieving for my wife's loss that she was going through. I was losing something, too, in the fact that my wife was hurting. And that's an important point, and Gloria would be the closest person. Obviously, she was losing something because her husband was suffering so much, and she needed space and time to process this. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I was quite self-centered, at least for that year and a half where I was at the height of my depression and disability. As I came out of that and in the years following, it became really clear to me that my suffering didn't just affect me, but it affected all those around me, primarily and maybe first and foremost those closest to me, which at that point was my wife. I only had one daughter who was 1 year old at the time. Even if she didn't know it, she probably felt some of her father's rejection and failed pursuit of her. But my wife Gloria was right there, and for her, she lost even just seemingly little things at first, like just my strength. I couldn't do any chores. I could never drive. I could never clean up after myself or help with virtually anything around the house. And then in the depression, there became more just the lack of emotional support or lack of friendship in that way. And then just caring for me after surgeries and having to be worried about me on the darkest days. And so I began to see that really affected her. And so in the book, I wanted to be careful just so that caregivers and those who are close to those suffering, just for them to grieve their own loss, because my life wasn't just changed, but so was my wife's life. And so I wrote that because I wanted those caregivers to be able to be honest with the Lord, be honest with others. It's okay for you, and if you're listening and you're in that situation, it's okay for you to be going through a hard time and for you to call it what it is. It's not selfish to say you're having a hard time. It's not selfish to need to spend time with the Lord to recharge. It's not selfish to need a break or to need a rest. One suffering affects all those around them.
And as the caregiver is going through, I mean, they have to process. I mean, they didn't ask for this. They didn't sign up for this. You know, it's like your own pain. You didn't ask for it. It's what God has written into your narrative, and now it has a ripple effect. You said in your book, the first answer to learning how to care for others begins with the caregiver's relationship with Christ. Why did you say that?
Yeah. If you are not walking with the Lord, you have nothing to give others. It's like a sponge. If the sponge is dry, nothing in it to give out. And so if you're in my wife's shoes or in your shoes caring for your wife, if the caregiver is not walking with Jesus, if they're not loving the Lord with all their heart, soul, mind, and strength, if they're not obeying that first commandment, it's going to be impossible to obey the second commandment, second great commandment, to love your neighbor as yourself. You're going to have failed perspective. You're going to have a lack of strength. And eventually there will be chaos in your own heart and you will run on empty and eventually implode. So that's why I started off the book in that way, of just walking with Jesus so you have nothing to give, and then grieving your loss. And then after you've done those two things, and after you're doing those two things, walking with Jesus and giving your burden to him, then at that point, Lord willing, through his strength, you can care for others.
Where does laughter fit in? Do you have a sense of humor?
Well, I think so. I hope so. I don't know if those around you would say that. I think so. I certainly like to laugh. I think laughter plays a big part. I think when you care for the hurting and you're trying to love those who are hurting, if you make their pain their identity, and if that's all you're talking about is their pain, if all you're talking about is tangible ways to serve them, if all you're talking about is whatever it is to point the spotlight on their disability or on their pain or depression or grief, you're missing out on perhaps what they need the most is a friend, is a faithful friend just to do life with them. And so you don't want to see the hurting person as your project. See them as a friend. So that means confessing sin, sharing your own struggles. It means doing fun things with them, and it means laughing with them and treating them just like anybody else in some sense of, yes, they can do fun things with you. They can laugh with you. So we have a pastor on staff named Glenn. He's from Australia, has a great sense of humor, and him and I love laughing together. He knows that the laughter and surprises and things like that are one of my love languages. So there's my wife, Gloria, and so the two of them at various times have surprised me with things. They've laughed at me, even made fun of me in ways that I enjoy, and have helped shift my perspective a bit and not be so serious and consumed with myself. And so I think being a faithful friend will include laughter and will include playing together and doing fun things, enjoying common grace that God gives us.
Yeah, you're not only an expert sufferer, but you are a superb senior pastor. And word on the street is that you have a singing gift, too. Is that true?
You're a great singer. Yeah, that would be probably the most false thing you've said. But at our second anniversary church kind of church celebration, that same pastor, Pastor Glenn from the great country of Australia, decided to play a little practical joke on me and play a duet that I once recorded in our church service. Of course, it was an accident. One of our other elders named Tom forgot to turn off my microphone one morning in our corporate worship service, and I began to sing. There's only one other singer singing at that moment, and so she thought our speakers were demon-possessed because she had no idea what was coming through them, and it was my voice during church service about 6 years ago. So that was a fun moment. But yes, I will not be trying out on American Idol anytime soon. That's for sure.
I am talking with Dave Furman, the author of Being There. It is a book written to those who care for those who are suffering. It is an outstanding book. It is theological. It is also practical, and he weaves his story throughout the book. It is an exceptional read. Dave, how do you, you don't want your identity to be suffering-centered. You want it to be Christ-centered. How do you turn those conversations? Because, I mean, that's what we want to talk about. I mean, and it comes from caring people. I mean, people love you. They care for you. They want to care. They want to know. They want updates and so forth. And how do you, again, we're talking, I was talking earlier about you leading others. You're the suffering one, but you have to lead. How do you lead folks through those conversations?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult. I think having patience, I think on both sides, as the sufferer, you want to, in God's grace, to be patient with those that try to help and are well-meaning. And I think on the flip side as well, for those who are helping the hurting, if you're out there and you're taking care of others, I just think we think of the fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. I think looking to Christ for our significance, and so it's very easy on either side to get your feelings hurt quite easily. And I think we've got to look to Jesus to give us patience with one another.
Yeah, I guess we're, you know, laughter and not taking ourselves so seriously, because there's awkwardness all over the place. And another area, I'm sure you have received, you know, probably 1,000 cures for cure suggestions, rather, you know, for what you're going through. I know when we were going, as we're going through cancer, well-meaning people who love us, there's a cure a day, and you really do have to navigate that, and you don't want to hurt feelings, and we just have to accept the awkwardness. The way that we always framed it is that people do care for us, and they're well-meaning, and they suggest these things because they do love us. Do you find yourself discouraged?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's some of our natural tendency to try to be the fix-it person. You know, we once tried something or heard of someone who's healed by some potion or some pill. I think I've received a whole closet full of, you know, magical potions or creams that were guaranteed to fix my nerve injury. It becomes slightly discouraging, although I think, like you said, to your wife's cancer, I think for the most part, I know where their heart is, and right, you know they're trying to help. But it also is discouraging, because if someone gives me a cream that they say it's going to heal me, then at the same time, it also tells me that they don't really understand what I'm going through. If my nerves are mangled, and if my nerves just don't work, and my pain is as intense as it is, then to think that a cream is all that I need to heal me also feels like they're undervaluing or underestimating, or just don't know the depth of my pain. So I think when we try to be the fix-it person, we might be honestly trying to help, but it could communicate we don't really know what's going on in that other person's life. And so I think we want to be leery of that. I think we want to be leery of feeling like we need to have all the answers.
And that's why we need your book, Dave. And I'm glad, and I'm not just saying that. Your book is helpful. This is a conversation that we do have to have, because people do care, and people want to say something. You're right. We're fixers. That's our bend, and we want to do something. We want to make your pain go away. And so we give you these ideas. Hey, by the way, if you have a closet full of lotions, you're welcome to ship me some.
I'm sure they'd be put to good use somehow.
I'll be glad to use them. I have some pain that I'd like to try some of your cures. Hey, so you got another book because you have a lot of spare time on your hands planning a church in Dubai. And so next January, tell me about this book you got coming out. Is this yours? Is Being There your first book?
It is. First book. And so second book is called Kiss the Wave, Embracing God in Your Trials. So this is the book that might be more typically written, perhaps, by someone who is suffering. So this is for the sufferer. This is for the hurting person. So in some sense, a companion book to the first one. First one for those who care for the hurting, second one for the ones who are hurting. So now this really should cover every human being on the planet. I'm not sure I'll sell 7 billion books, but but it does cover all of us. And this book, it's named after a quote that's often attributed to Charles Spurgeon. We don't know that he actually said it, but it's a quote about in our suffering, in our difficult times, when the waves of our trials come crashing down on us, our temptations might be to reject God or be angry at God and the trial or try to run away from God, but instead to embrace the wave that draws us and crashes us and brings us to the rock of ages, meaning in our trials, God is with us as believers. God is there. God is sovereignly in control. And we need to look to God and look to what he's done and who he is to be our encouragement. So in that upcoming book, I talk a lot about who God is and what he's done for us and as the main encouragement in our trials, rather than looking to the world, rather than running from God, rather than running to our feelings, instead running to him.
Well, I was going to ask you to give a word to those who are suffering, going through suffering. There are millions of people who are suffering, and you just did, but let me give you another opportunity to say something else just as profound. If you want to give some encouragement, some practical advice to people who are going through chronic pain, and you had just a few seconds to say something to them, what would you say?
Yeah, I would say God loved you so much that he gave his one and only son, Jesus, to die on the cross to save you from your sins. And I would just plead and say, look to him, friend, look to him. He is in control over your life. He loves you. He will not leave you. He will not forsake you. He will not forget you. He is there with you in the midst of the pain, in that dark night of the soul, in those difficult moments. He is there. It might not feel like it today, but he is.
And if you would like to receive counseling from Dave Furman, I would recommend that you do get his book. Being There is an exceptional book. Dave is the senior pastor of Redeemer Church in Dubai. He and his wife, Gloria, and you have 4 kids, right?
Yes, 4 kids, 10, 8, 6, and an energetic 3.5-year-old boy.
Serve in Dubai and God is doing a good work through them there. God is not only being glorified, but people are being helped. Dave, thank you so much for taking the time with me this morning. It is 9:46 on the East Coast, and it is what, 5:46?
Yes, it's getting close to dinner time for us over here
in Dubai. What's it? I've got to let you go, but I have a million questions for you. Let me ask one more. What's it like living in Dubai?
Yeah, it's a joy. I think we love it. We love the church. It's one of the most diverse cities in the world. And so our church itself has about 60 or 70 different nationalities. Our church is about 90% Easterners and Africans, which is really the feel of the city. So every time we gather for corporate worship, it's a little taste of heaven. Getting together with the nations, being in the city, you see image bearers that God has made from all over the world. And so today I sat around at our staff meeting with people from India and the Philippines and Australia and, oh, I'm sure I'm missing some countries. We have an elder from Kenya. We have people from all over the place, and it's a joy to wake up in the morning and live in this place.
Yeah, the brief times that I served in New York City, Queens specifically, that is the thing that I love the most. I was like the only white person there, and it was absolutely fantastic. Because you're right, it that was my thought. It gave me a picture of what heaven was going to be like, with just the multiple nationalities. That has to be a fantastic experience. So, is sunny and sandy in Dubai?
It is pretty much sunny, sandy, and hot. So we don't have to really look at the weather reports very often. I'm opening now, and it's, let's see, the next 8 days, it's sunny, 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 and sunny at over 100 degrees every day. So there you go. I won't open it up again until October or November.
Dave Furman, if you're in Dubai, stop at Redeemer Church, and if you can't get there, buy his book. I have it here in the show notes. You can click the Amazon to get his book. I have a short video here. I'll also add the Martin Lloyd-Jones book and the Milton Vincent book for those that would like to read Dave's recommendations. The Lord has used those two authors to help him as he's gone through, or as he's going through his suffering. Dave, thank you so much. This has been a great encouragement.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to Life Over Coffee with Rick Thomas. If you have a question for Rick, you can let him know by sending him a note through his website, rickthomas.net. That's rickthomas.net. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your coffee.